Good evening, friends. I'm deeply honored to be able to deliver this Richard Johnson lecture. As we have heard John speak, it's an amazing legacy that he, Richard Johnson, has left behind. And I do hope that my own lecture will in a small way honor that legacy. I'm delighted to be in this beautiful and vibrant city of Sydney. This is a wonderful hall, and you are a wonderful audience, and if I could see the hall and if I could see you, I would be happier. But things are as they are. My topic this evening is religions, secular humanism, and public role of faith. Now, first I want to sketch to you a kind of a basic, two basic, very opposing stances, and I will describe them as religious exclusive, political exclusivism, and secular political exclusivism. Now, these designations are extreme, but the phenomena are prevalent. And designation, as I have coined them, come from me kind of looking at the phenomena at a distance and then squinting a bit in order to kind of blend away nuances and so forth so we can see the phenomena in their relatively pure form. Sociologists call that ideal types. Something like that I will do, and hopefully that will provide for us a background against which we can then reflect on the place of religion in contemporary societies. So let's start first with religious political exclusivism. Religious exclusion of all competitors from political, from public life. That's kind of definition almost of religious political exclusivism. Political community finds its unity in a particular religion, and that religion legitimizes political rule. Public space should reflect religious character of political community, be marked by visible sign of the presence, symbols of the presence of that religious community. Secular humanism, and perhaps especially rival religions, should be excluded from public life, banished into private sphere, with hope that they will eventually disappear altogether, that the light of truth will take over their darkness of ignorance. Now, fear that drives religious political exclusivists, fear is of other religions. They will lead people to give ultimately allegiance to wrong things, to a wrong God, and are therefore dangerous for the souls of individuals and also for the entire society. As to the secular humanism, which is also excluded, secular humanism, according to this vision, misconstrues the basic character of human beings and does so by not seeing them as open and in need of transcendence. And, say, combined with the forces of market, turns human beings into shallow pleasure seekers and robs them of a deeper meaning. And combined with culturally prevalent stance of soft relativism, some of you will recall, especially Charles Taylor's analysis of soft relativism, combined with this soft relativism is in fact fiercely intolerant and is so in the guise of tolerance. And Benedict XVI, the previous pope, has articulated this sense of intolerance of soft relativism by the phrase dictatorship of relativism. Now that's kind of religious political exclusivism. Now in contrast, opposition to that, you have something like a secular exclusion of religion from public life. The state here is a strictly secular institution. Public space also has secular character, and ideally, all traces except the kinds of monuments of which stand to Richard Johnson in this beautiful city, all traces of religion ought to be kind of pushed back, banished into from public space. And religions themselves should kind of retreat into private sphere. Eventually, too, the hope is that they will disappear. And the reason for that is that, of course, religions are irrational as they operate with reasons that are not accessible to all. They're based on some private revelation or on something that's accessible only to religious people and therefore cannot be and should not be in any way mediated and imposed upon the rest of the society. And since religious people tend to do that, they're also described as intolerant. Now, the fear of secular political exclusivists is that if religions are allowed a role in public life, they will push for something like return to pre-scientific obscurantism and moral traditionalism. They will plunge political community either into authoritarianism or into violence, or most likely into both. Hence, secular humanists are prone to undertake one or the other form of, well, here's, I betray my origin, of religious cleansing. You remember ethnic cleansing from Bosnia? That's the term that we invented in the region of the world from which I come. This kind of religious cleansing that needs to take place, and sometimes in the historic, especially 20th century, it has taken place in a violent way, through variety of forms of Marxism are example of that, or it can be democratically mediated undertaking in case of liberal secularism. So you've got these two kinds of political exclusivism. Again, remember, I'm squinting, I'm looking from a distance, I'm painting a caricature, in a sense, for you to make it clear, kind of clean types of these two stances. What is common to secular and religious political exclusivists is one, that they both anticipate that the contemporary world and modern societies are either secular or secularizing, or at least the religious people fear that. Secular humanists celebrate this development and see in religions a kind of last gasps of irrationality before the victory of reason. Of course, religious people see it quite in the opposite way. They see in secularism kind of a slide of humanity to self-debasing morality. What's common to them also is certain form of exclusivism. Competitors must be removed. And in this lecture, I want to suggest that both are wrong and that both are wrong on both counts. The world is not secularizing, and political exclusivism is morally unacceptable. So let's look now at the vitality of religion, social pluralism, and pluralistic democracy. Now, continued vitality of religions is indisputable. World religions are growing, and I have said that many times, are growing in absolute and relative terms. It's clear to see that they're growing in absolute terms, and partly they're growing in absolute terms because of the increase of world population. But they're also growing in relative terms. It's not just that there are that in 1970 there were 550 million Muslims, and in 2005 there are 1.3 billion. It's not that in those years there were 1.2 billion of Christians, and there are, in 2005 there are 2.1 billion Christians, but five major world faiths have also increased relative share of world population from 67.8% to 72.4%. Not a high increase, but significant one nonetheless. Now, number of secularists, secular humanists, or secular non-humanists, right, is growing as well, and it's growing in absolute terms. But not in relative terms, and consequently, world is becoming increasingly more and more religious place. Now, places like Europe immediately, or Australia, some of the Western countries will be immediately given as an example, and it's not quite clear what they're examples of and how to interpret them. And sociologists go back and forth whether, for instance, America is more paradigmatic and Europe and maybe Australia is an exception to the rule, or it's vice versa. But I think what is clear, if one steps back from a local situation, steps back and looks at the world as a whole, it is clear that the world as a whole is becoming an increasingly religious place. And then contemporary societies are manifestly not secular. Now, claim that contemporary societies are secular, just like the claim that contemporary universities, for instance, are secular, I think it's a form of ideology. It is a kind of way of seeing things, way of desiring and projecting things into that space, but it's actually not true. They're pluralistic, and they're becoming less and less, in fact, secular. And that's true also of the so-called developing society. That's true of so-called developing societies, and I think in the long run it's going to be true also of Western societies, partly because of transnational migration and partly because of the kind of differentials in birth rates between different groups of folks. Now, consequence for that, I think, needs to be drawn for the nature and character of contemporary state and the character of public life. Continued vibrancy and political assertiveness of religion, that's one of my assumptions. Now, the second assumption is acceptance of equality and fairness as fundamental social values. Now, you'll notice that my argument will not be from social utility of religion. It will also not be from the fact that I consider religion to be somehow the good for society. It's actually based on fairness. It's based on rights. We can make the other argument as well, but my argument for tonight is the argument for rights of individuals rather than from the good of religion. Now, if that's true, if my two assumptions are true, even actually if the first assumption, which is increased growth of religion, vitality and assertiveness, even if that assumption weren't right, my still argument would hold true, but it holds true even more, or it's more important if it's true that religions continue to be vibrant and politically assertive. As a consequence, I think the state should neither be religious nor it should be secular, but it should be neutral. And more precisely, I think it should be impartial, impartial toward all overarching interpretations of life. Not supporting one, if not supporting one, not supporting any. If promoting one, promoting equally all. Now, when I put it this way, of course, you will immediately say, and I will concur with you, that the devil is in the details, right? It's not so much that this vision isn't compelling, and many people find it, I think, compelling. The challenge will be, how do you implement it in highly pluralistic societies? How do you make the decisions of what means then equality for all religions? How do you not then have a kind of some kind of a secular space, but actually you have a equal representation of all religion? What religions, what that means? So one thing, state is impartial. Second, each citizen should have equal voice in public affairs. Equal voice in that citizen's own terminology, in their own ways of presenting things, rather than seeking, needing to see some kind of public reason to mediate what they, on other reasons, believe. Now, the religious folks might not be particularly smart to give biblical reasons in public realm because they may not find the hearing for those reasons, but in principle, they should be allowed to bring any reasons that they consider to be compelling to them. So, what I'm advocating here is that suppressing religious voices from public life is a mode of injustice. It's a mode of oppression. It's a mode of trampling on people's rights. Suppressing secular, religious and also certain forms of secular voices, I think, undermines, in fact, democracy, not just because it tramples on rights, but it also because it presses alternative into underground and therefore makes them much more dangerous for democracy itself. So I'm advocating here is something like what I've called elsewhere faith-friendly democracy. Or, I would rather put it this way, a democracy that is friendly both to religions and to varieties of our religion. And I say faith-friendly, not faith-based, and I say pluralistic rather than exclusivistic. Now, in varieties of settings, this kind of vision would have to be applied concretely because each of the particular settings has its own historical legacy that needs to be respected. But roughly, I think that is the direction in which we ought to move. Now, let's assume that I'm right. Now, I know that some of you, that might be a big assumption, but let's assume for a moment that I'm right. We should strive to recast political order, to be more pluralistic, and therefore also more faith-friendly. Now, you might ask, well, what about faiths themselves? Can faiths themselves be friendly to democracy? Aren't they authoritarian? Or, I think, more fundamental question, can there be friendly to pluralistic democracy? Aren't faiths exclusivistic? And in fact, secular exclusion of religion from public life rests in part on the conviction that religion is inherently intolerant and that is inherently not pluralistic. So my next section is faith and pluralistic democracy, or faiths and pluralistic democracy. And I'll ask the question, are faiths democracy friendly? And are faiths friendly to pluralistic democracy? So are they democracy friendly? Now, one of the most extraordinary developments of the 20th century is the spread of democracy. The most powerful, energizing idea of the 20th century, as Anthony Giddens has called it. The democratic ideal has conquered the world. And interestingly enough, by far, the most adherents of world religions embrace democracy. Now, that may be a surprise to some. And in some ways, it's easy to see why it would be a surprise, because for long stretches of their history, religions have not embraced democracy. And especially if you look at monotheism, what you had is prevalence of one possibility of how monotheism relates to political order. One God was seen to justify and underwrite the rule of the one ruler. So to say, God and ruler were on one side and they stood as opposed in opposition or in contrast to all the people. But it's possible to think of the relationship between God, one and many, in a different way. And indeed, at the very origins, say, of Israel's search for the king, you have this debate between Samuel and the Israelite people, and kind of God mixes himself into this debate. Israelites want the king, and God says to Samuel, they have abandoned me. God sees a contrast between king and himself because there is a direct relationship between God and people. Here, then, you don't have God one and all. You have it the other way around, God all and then possibly one or many, whoever ruled then as delegated from the people. So this other possibility, I think, is very much alive, and it's not just kind of made up from the beginning. It was present there. Now, since world religions, it's true of Christianity, it's true of other world religions as well, since they always address human beings as individuals and confront them with what they claim to be truth about human existence, religions, just for that reason, place responsibility for the kind of life a person will lead into that person's own hands. This is the bedrock idea, I think, of democracy. Now, some of you might say, well, aren't there really exceptions to this? And often people cite Islam as an exception to this. But also there are very important strands in Islam which take the central creed of Islam, no God but God, as precisely implying direct rule of God over people unmediated by political authorities. Indeed, representative of Muslim Brotherhood Said Qutb does precisely that. But interestingly also enough, and in line with this thinking, majority of Muslims in the world prefer democracy over a strong leader. There's one exception, one regional exception, and that's South Asia, where 45% do. But otherwise, great majority of Muslims prefer democracy over a strong leader, and overwhelming majority embrace religious freedom. Say 85% of Muslims in Middle East to about 97% of them in North Africa. So it seems clear that religions are democracy friendly. Now, one of the central questions is, are religions also friendly to pluralistic democracy? And here the answer is not so clear. I want to make argument that they are, but that argument is somewhat harder to make than for the fact that religions are democracy friendly. Now, many religious people are not friendly to pluralistic democracy, and historically, they have not been. To stay with the example of Islam, high percentage of world Muslims favor making Islamic law, Sharia, the official law of their country. Now, that's not particularly pluralistic. Even if it's true that half think that it should apply to all, only half think that it should apply to all citizens rather than to Muslims alone. And you've got similar sentiments among other religions as well. You have to keep in mind that in the Roman Catholic Church, in the official teaching, it's only in the 60s that the idea of religious freedom has actually been embraced. So faiths are happy to embrace democracy, but they embrace an exclusivistic form of a democracy where people have sovereignty, but within a single overarching interpretation of life. So why do religious people do that? Well, because how could we think of faith as wrong and the way of life that it advocates as harmful while at the same time believing that it's good to allow it to flourish? You kind of have to curtail that. It's a weed that has to be kind of taken away so that the good plants can grow. Or sometimes religious people would affirm freedom of religion for themselves, but would deny it for others. And that's kind of discrepancy in kind of self-interested discrepancy in their position. But if faith is a free act of a person, if faith is not simply conformity to beliefs and practices, then it requires ascription of responsibility to the person for the character and for trajectory of their lives. And this kind of an anthropological condition of possibility, if you want to put it this way, of religious claim upon our life. Each religion makes, world religion makes a claim upon individual life. For a religion to be able to make that claim, it has to be the case that it assumes that I have responsibility for my life. And this affirmation of the responsibility for my life, for trajectory of my life, is a foundational stone for embrace also of pluralistic democracy. So to be consistent, world religions must embrace freedom of religion for all, freedom to embrace religion, and freedom also to reject it. Now, therefore, religions are capable of embracing pluralism as a political project. Now, there's one significant obstacle. It's a major obstacle. And see whether we can figure out how to negotiate our way through that. Most adherents of world religions are not just political exclusivists, they're also religious exclusivists, and primarily they are also religious exclusivists, which is to say that they think that their faith is the true faith, and although they may not deny that there is truth in other faiths, they still believe that theirs is the true faith, and they judge other faiths in the light of the truth of their own faith. Now, question is, are religious exclusivists necessarily also political exclusivists? Some people argue that that's exactly the case. The fierce version of it, religious exclusivists will be political exclusivists which advocate some kind of totalitarianism, saturation of public space with their own religion. Or they can have a little bit of softer version of that and advocate strong authoritarianism. For a while, I was teaching a course at Yale entitled Faiths and Globalization. And every single time I taught that course, on very first session of that course, one student would raise their hand, and first time I taught it, it was the first question that was ever raised in that course, was exactly about this. Most religious people are religious exclusivists. How can religious exclusivists be advocates of political pluralism? And one of the students who raised that question had in his question, he was a religious person himself, and in his question you could detect the echoes of Rousseau's social contract. And toward the end of Rousseau's social contract, some of you who know the text will recall that he raises precisely this question. Let me read what he says. Those who distinguish civil intolerance, let's say social political intolerance, or in my terms, exclusivism, from theological intolerance or religious exclusivism, those who distinguish civil intolerance from theological intolerance are, in my opinion, mistaken. These two kinds of intolerance are inseparable. It is impossible to live in peace with people whom we believe to be damned. To love them would be to hate God who punishes them. It is absolutely necessary to reclaim them or to punish them. Wherever theological intolerance is allowed, it cannot but have some effect in civil life, and as soon as it has any, the sovereign is no longer sovereign, even in secular affairs. From that time, the priests are the real masters, the kings are their officers. You let religious exclusivity into the house of common life, and that's like camel's nose in your tent. You are gone in no time. Religion is going to swallow you and pull your house down. Now, many secularists and also many religious people believe just like that. But are they right? Is affirmation of freedom of religion and freedom of a way of life described by religion, is this just a kind of a modern idea of recent origin with no roots in religion itself? Is religious pluralism, is political pluralism, simply a modern idea that religious people have to kind of adjust themselves against the grain of their own better judgments? Now, I think the best way to answer this question is to look in history, and in fact, to look at the origins of political pluralism. And I haven't traced the roots all the way back, it's a complex story, but one person is certainly close to the origin of Western forms of political pluralism. And this is a guy of whom probably you've never heard. His name is Thomas Helvis. He lived at the tail end of the 16th century and the beginning of the 17th century, and he wrote a book with the title A Short Declaration of the Mystery of Iniquity. It's not a friendly title, right? There's your religious exclusivist already in the title. He's telling you what's going to happen here. But listen what he says. What is this mystery of iniquity? The king is a mortal man and not God. Therefore, he has no power over the immortal souls of his subjects to make laws and ordinances for them, to set spiritual lords over them. Atheists, pagans, Jews, Muslims, all have, according to Thomas Helvis, equal rights. The thesis was revolutionary because he said each immortal soul, whether of a heretical Christian or a Jew or Muslim or an atheist, is free from the state's interference with regard to its faith. Now, he wrote that book in Amsterdam, traveled to London, published it there, and then sent it to the king. and the king promptly put him to jail. And it's in jail that he died also. But not before Roger Williams have taken note of him. And Roger Williams, between his work and where he lived, he had to pass by that prison. And the theory is that he knew of Thomas Helvis in prison and that he knew of the book. And it's to Roger Williams that we actually owe the first political first institutionalization of political pluralism in the Western societies, which is a state of Rhode Island in United States. Both of these folks were fierce religious exclusivists. And just because they had strong Christian convictions, just because of that, they were also political pluralists. So strong religious exclusivists can be, and have been, at the very origin of political pluralism. Now, secular humanists have also contested political pluralism. Secular exclusivists, right? We have many examples. That kind of secular exclusivism also pushes against the notion of political pluralism. And so in conclusion, what I wanted to say is that religious people and secular humanists, we don't have problem with democracy, but we both have problem with pluralistic democracy. Religious political exclusivism and secular political exclusivism mirror each other and condition each other, as I've suggested at the beginning of the lecture. The challenge, I think, of our time, in which multiple overarching interpretations of life exist under the same political roof, is to find a way to embrace just such democratic pluralism. Adherents of world faiths have internal resources to embrace democratic pluralism, even when they advocate exclusivist forms of religiosity, or so I have argued in this lecture. Now, maybe it would take another lecture, and maybe it is a completely obvious thing, that secular humanists have resources to embrace democratic, pluralistic democracy. There are folks, serious philosophers, who doubt that, because they doubt that secular humanism has sufficient philosophical resources to justify human rights. But I leave that aside and assume that embrace of political pluralism is possible. So challenge is to articulate compelling local political visions and establish and maintain political institutions which will be truly pluralistic, giving equal voice to each citizen, no matter what their religious persuasion or our religious persuasion, maintain impartiality of the state toward all overarching interpretations of life, and create hospitable public spaces and institutions in which all citizens, diverse citizens, religious and irreligious, would feel at home. Thank you very much.